Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. We have with us today in the studio a very special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, a research psychiatrist from UCLA. If any of our listeners watched the documentary Expelled, they certainly heard from Dr. Schwartz and his views about the debate over intelligent design and evolution. And it's really a pleasure and honor to have you in the studio with us today, Dr. Schwartz.
And hi, Casey.
Well, I want to talk to you about your research on obsessive compulsive disorder, which, from what my understanding is, has some very big implications for the debate over whether the mind is simply a part of the brain or if it's distinct from the brain and that sort of thing. Could you first explain to us what are the implications of the debate of the interaction over the mind and the brain?
Thanks. Yeah, the research on obsessive compulsive disorder was very theory driven, because I actually saw obsessive compulsive disorder as a very good research vehicle for understanding the relationship between the mind and the brain. And perhaps the simplest way to understand the relationship is that we could view the brain as essentially being the input or the passive side of experience, which is, of course, the vast part of what our experience is. I mean, your eyes are closed, you open your eyes, you see things in front of you. It's very, very fair and straightforwardly true and part of the conventional neurophysiological wisdom to say this has to do with light entering our eye, impinging on our retina, going up the optic nerve, and being processed by all the very complex brain physiology in the posterior part of the brain, etc. That's fine. And of course, you can do analogous kinds of understanding for all the other senses. However, where that model breaks down is at the point when people make decisions about what aspect of their visual or auditory or tactile experience they're going to focus their attention on. And there we get to the key term, focus of attention. So that when we want to talk about within a scientific context, this mind-brain relationship, the easiest way to do it is to remember that when we're talking about mind, we're talking about focus of attention and specifically the choices that people make about how to focus their attention. And when we're talking about the brain, we're really more talking about what you might call the experiential aspects that are received by the sensory input that forms what you might consider the content about which we make decisions about what to focus on. So the key word for mind-brain relation really does become focus, which is mind, on experience, which is largely, very largely, what the brain does.
That's a very helpful explanation to understand what these different terms are doing in terms of our everyday experience. So what has your research looked at, and what have its implications been on the interaction of the mind and the brain?
So exactly thinking in that way, and this is described in the introduction and the early chapters of my book, The Mind and the Brain, when I found out that there was a disorder, and partly at UCLA we were involved in discovering the nature of this disorder called obsessive compulsive disorder, that there were brain mechanisms having to do with connections between a specific part of the front of the brain called the orbitofrontal cortex, which sits right over the eye sockets or orbits. And this part of the brain, which is now an extremely well-studied area, but 25 years ago it wasn't, and is now known to, among other things, contain error detection circuitry, and in general is involved in making emotional valuations about our environmental input. So we found, through multiple rounds of research and very reproduced data, now really an archival finding in the history of psychiatry, that this orbitofrontal cortex is overactive in people who have obsessive compulsive disorder. And we made this discovery in a series of studies during the 1980s. So now I had this model to work with where I could see that it was understandable that the reason why people were having this intrusive, bothersome urge to wash or urge to check And I guess I could also throw in that if you want to see a very well-portrayed view of how obsessive-compulsive disorder presents itself in real life, you could watch The Aviator, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, directed by Martin Scorsese. And I was a consultant on that film, and I can vouch for the fact that the OCD in that film was presented very accurately. And now we understand that the reason why Howard Hughes in that film, but obsessive-compulsive disorder in general, is a condition which is largely caused by this overactive error detection circuitry in this specific area of the brain called the orbital frontal cortex. That created a really interesting model to study mind-brain relations, because I had the idea that if we get people to understand these intrusive, bothersome urges to wash again and again, or to check in again and again. And the thing that's really important to remember is that people with obsessive compulsive disorder, I mean, they know that these urges don't really make sense, but the thing is they're so visceral and they're so bothersome and they're so persistent and they're so intrusive that they tend to capitulate to them, because you're really under this tremendous internal feeling that I'm dirty, something's wrong, it needs to be checked. You know it doesn't really make sense, but it's very, very, very bothersome. So what we did was use a philosophy of mindful awareness, or what I now prefer the term impartial spectator, which tells people, you know, this is really just your brain sending you a false message. You can take this more objective third-person perspective on your experience, understand that it's just your brain sending you a false message, and with that kind of cognitive reframing, you reframe your experience to say, hey, this isn't me needing to check again. This is my brain sending me a false message telling me to check again, but it's a false message. It's like a false alarm. It's bothersome. It's loud. It's intrusive, but it doesn't mean there's a fire. I know there's a false alarm. It doesn't mean that somebody's stealing my car, because my car alarm is going off when it shouldn't. It's annoying, but you don't worry about it. And so what we tried to do is then get people to refocus their attention on more adaptive behaviors. And my hypothesis was that if we did that, we would start to quiet down the orbital frontal cortex and restructure the way the brain responded to these symptoms. And that's what we were fortunate to find using positron emission tomography brain imaging, that refocusing attention in this systematic way not only improved symptom expression, it actually weakened the underlying orbital frontal cortex error detection circuitry. So in that way, refocus of attention literally changed a pathological circuitry that is essentially certainly genetically inherited, at least in part. So that's become a paradigm example of research showing mind's effect on brain.
Wow. And explain for our listeners, how does this show us that the brain is not simply a material phenomenon?
When you get into the deep underlying philosophy, you can get into, you know, very complex arguments. But from a practicing physician's perspective, from the point of view of a practicing psychologist or a practicing psychiatrist, it becomes extremely important to motivate the person to resist the urges. And so, yes, we can get into deeper arguments, and in numbers of my writings, I have gotten into deeper arguments. But right at the surface level, in terms of basically the clinical and political implications of this, and the implications of this for viewing people as free beings who can make choices, you need to motivate people to resist these urges, because these urges, you have to remember, are extremely bothersome. And if you take the position that the only thing that can change anything that is caused by the brain is the brain itself, then you are reduced from the clinical perspective of telling people that the only thing that can help them is either giving them a drug, doing psychosurgery, putting an electrode in their brain, or giving them a shock treatment. And that's become kind of a battle cry for me, because too much of my own field of psychiatry has degenerated, and I use that word advisedly, degenerated into the clinical practice of basically we change the brain, not we change the mind. But once you realize that from a clinical perspective, changing focus of attention can itself change the brain, then you need to motivate people to believe they have the capacity to do something about what their brain is doing. So I mean, yes, it gets deeper and more technical in terms of the lines of argumentation when you're arguing with academic philosophers about this, but right at the ground level, and this is very important, at the pragmatic level of what a doctor has to do to treat their suffering patient, you must imbue the person with a sense that they have a capacity not to give in to these feelings because they're caused by the brain. In the prevailing regnant paradigm, the fact that it's caused by the brain means that your mind can't do anything about it because only the brain can change the brain in a materialist perspective. But once you change that frame, we've clearly shown that once people make different choices and change their focus of attention, that itself changes the brain. So right at the most ground level pragmatic point of view, you've got to motivate people not to give in to these bothersome urges. And having a non-materialist view that imbues the person with this empowered sense that they can refocus and change their own brain immediately shows that the materialist paradigm, at least in medicine, should be done away with.
You know, a lot of times we hear from people, what are the real-world implications of these debates over materialism? It sounds to me like this is one area where there are huge real-world implications for how we're going to practice medicine, how we're going to treat illnesses, mental illnesses, or diseases, and so forth. And it just seems like this debate has so much real-world meaning in this field. Would you agree with that?
Amen, I'd agree with that. I mean, that's really the point. You know, these materialists, and I'll leave them unmentioned because everybody at this point knows who the prominent people's names are. I mean, they make believe that this is like all to the good, that, you know, we're kind of removing people's false sense of being guilty or some nonsense. I mean, in fact, it's evil because it's basically changed the practice of mental health, especially at the level where psychopharmacology has now become so overwhelmingly predominant. And I mean, I'm all for the proper use of psychiatric drugs, but the proper use of psychiatric drugs is to empower people to make better choices about what their brain is doing when their brain isn't working the way it should, or when they're having brain pathology that's causing mental symptoms, then giving a medication that ameliorates that brain circuitry empowers the person to make better choices about what they're doing, and that really forms a virtuous cycle. All the aspects of that virtuous cycle get undermined if you're saying that the drug is the primary treatment. So right at the level of the use of psychiatric drugs in society, it puts too much power in the hands of the prescription writing doctor and the use of psychiatric drugs for things like attention deficit disorder and on and on and on, and all the excessive use of psychiatric drugs in our society, a lot of that is generated by this materialist paradigm. So, man, there is nothing innocent about it. It has huge negative implications for our culture, the materialist paradigm, and it should be understood as such. This is by no means just an academic philosophical debate.
Wow, and when you start talking about the drug companies getting involved with the debate, then it's no longer even just, you know, an academic philosophical or scientific. There's a lot of money and other things involved.
There is
too.
A lot of money. Now, don't get me wrong, because I mean, you know, the pharmaceutical industry could really be helpful in all of this, and I have done more than my share of consulting over the years, maybe not in recent years, but I wouldn't mind doing more of it, to be honest. But in years gone by, I did a lot of consulting with pharmaceutical industry. So the pharmaceutical industry does not need to be the villain in this. All it really does require, though, is the pharmaceutical industry understanding more clearly than they do in at the current time. But candidly, the pharmaceutical industry has learned a lot in the last couple of years, because anybody who follows their stocks know that those stocks haven't been doing very well for the last 5 years or so. And part of that is because they too got entrapped in this materialist way of thinking, and it has really impeded the clinical application, especially in the field of psychopharmacology. The pharmaceutical industry could really get on the right side of this by again stressing the fact that pharmaceutical agents in psychiatry are empowering if they are used in a way that help people make better choices about what their brain is doing and focus their attention more effectively and empower people to to assert their own will more effectively. And that also gets into the very huge issue of medication compliance. I mean, I've been talking to the pharmaceutical industry for going on three decades about this. And they all agree, but you know, hopefully going forward, they're going to get a little bit more proactive of realizing that if the pharmaceutical industry would view themselves as empowering people rather than basically helping doctors just change their brains or make these bothersome symptoms go away by materialist brain mechanisms alone, they would get better compliance. People would believe that they don't have to be on these drugs at the same dose all their lives, that what they do with their minds very much influences the dose of drug that they need. So, you know, this is an open invitation by me to the pharmaceutical industry. Hey, guys, like, get on the right side of this argument and you can stop being the villain. It would be a good thing to do. It wouldn't be hard. And you'd increase your profits as well.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, it's very, very wonderful to have your perspective, your very specialized perspective on this issue. It's obvious that you have spent many years in this field and have just amassed a tremendous amount of information about what is right and what is wrong with it. So I really appreciate your sharing your wisdom with us today. Thank you very much.
Nice to have the opportunity to do that, Casey. I appreciate it.
Well, we hope to have you back on the show soon. So in the meantime, this is Casey Leskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.